I'm going to talk about healthcare expenditures for kids with autism during times of transition and our findings that some disadvantaged families appear to fall behind. This work was done with my colleagues Susan Parrish at Brandeis and Christiana Williams at UNC. This work was funded by the Health Resources and Services Administration, and I have, and you can't hear back there, okay. Is that better? And we have no relationships to disclose. Okay, so we haven't been talking about autism during this whole session, but you probably all know that the prevalence of autism has been increasing dramatically over time, and it's really gained a noticeable presence, and it's an area of big concern. At this point, there are about 1 out of every 110 kids who have autism. Families raising kids with autism experience difficulties accessing services more than typical kids, more than kids with other kinds of special health care needs. Schools provide a kind of backbone of services for these kids around which families wrap a whole bunch of other services that they use from the medical care system and other places as well. We know that child need, family socioeconomic status, and state policies are all associated with kid access to care. We also know that the mix of services that these kids use change over time. Children's symptoms tend to improve and then level off. And we know that both expenditures and family report of unmet need for services increase as children age. For kids with autism, transition is difficult in and of itself, and we wanted to just think about this a little bit. Did I do that right? There we go. Okay. So a defining feature of autism is that a person has evidence of inflexible adherence to specific non-functional routines or rituals. We know that transition to a new school requires a whole bunch of new routines, and that these new routines can be challenging and are often associated with problem behaviors for kids. But we realize that the impact of school transition on service use is an unanswered question right now. So to start thinking about this, we use two kind of nested conceptual frameworks. First, we use the familiar Anderson model of healthcare use, where a child's predisposing, enabling, and need characteristics, along with the context in which they live, affect their use of health services and their ultimate outcomes. We also thought about a kind of life course theory that says that the experiences that a kid has over the course of their life affect their health and well-being. And so in that way, this sort of age and developmental milestones of a kid inform the kind of level of need of a kid in the Anderson model here. So our research questions were for this work, what's the composition of services overall, and does it differ amongst the services that are paid for out of pocket by families? So just in the past few years, there's more research coming out that tells us about the composition of service use for kids with autism. It's mostly in the from Medicaid data, but there's a little bit of market scan private data out there. But we kids on Medicaid don't have much out-of-pocket expenditure, and the market scan data focus on the claims that were paid, not the out-of-pocket part. So out-of-pocket expenditures are still kind of a mystery. So we wanted to look at that. And then second, do transition-age children have higher total and out-of-pocket healthcare expenditures than other kids with autism? And does the effect of transition differ for families who typically experience difficulties accessing care? So we use a medical expenditure panel survey, the MEPS. The MEPS is representative of our national non-institutionalized civilian population. We pooled data from 2000 to 2009, so we had an adequate sample of kids with autism to look at. We examined children who were 20 years old or younger. So we're thinking about kids who are able to still be in high school this way. And they had autism in this data set. It's parent report of a kid having autism. But then there's some clinical input in examining what parents say that's then categorized into different kind of diagnostic groups, and that's how we get back to autism. And by pooling, we had a little over 300 kids. So in our sample, this is just to sort of show you who we have. We define school transition age as kids who are 5 or 6, that is going into kindergarten or first grade, 11 going into middle school, 14 going into high school. 18% of our kids were transition age. 15% were minority race. 9% had experienced some span of no insurance over the past year. The MEPS has really great data on health insurance, Medicaid, private insurance, other kinds of things. So these are just some summary picture of where these kids stand. It's surprising that almost 10% experienced some time without insurance at all. 62% of our parents had at least some college. A third of this group were low income. 12% of these children were living in a household headed by a single mom. 24% of kids were highly impaired. We used the Columbia Impairment Scale for the kids up to age 17, and then for the 18 through 20-year-olds, we used some questions about limitations in the MEPS, about needing supervision or active support all the time. 15% were living in a rural area. Looking at expenditures amongst all the kids with autism, looking just at total expenditures, half of these kids spent $2,600 or less, but 25% were spending $6,500 or more. It's our top quartile. Out-of-pocket expenditures were a lot lower, but still significant. Half the kids were paying a little less than $400 a year, but 25% were paying over $800 a year out-of-pocket. This shows the composition of expenditures, total expenditures among all our children, and you can see how the kind of detail or fine-grainedness that the MEPS allows us to look at. About a third of kids' expenses were for outpatient medical care, a third were for prescription medications. Dental visits, surprisingly, were really high. We hear a lot of times that these kids have a hard time finding a dentist who will take care of them, and then when they do, there's a lot more involved in caring for that kid with autism. They often have to have a lot more staff people. They may have medication to help them get through the experience. So I think that's what we see reflected there. A lot of home health care, too. It makes sense in terms of the patterns of services that kids with autism use, but I didn't really know that insurance was actually paying for it, so that's interesting to see. And then small things for other categories. This shows, and did it mess up on your screen too? I used to have the word separate, I'm sorry, but this shows the same set of categories, and it's the percentage spent, percentage for each spent out of pocket by the family. So the most dramatic thing, if you look back and forth, is that families are paying a disproportionate amount of the expense for prescription medications. And they're not paying as much for, say, home health care or emergency rooms, because that's the kind of thing that insurance will pay for. About the same amount of going out of pocket for the cost of outpatient medical care. So we ran two-part models to look at factors associated with total and out-of-pocket expenditures. So first, we modeled the probability that a kid had any expenditures. Then among kids that did, we looked at factors associated with those expenditures. We controlled for predisposing characteristics, kid age and race, enabling things, income, kid health insurance, parent education, and need, the level of impairment, and rural residence. And this just shows what we wanted to focus on and kind of the patterns of our findings. We looked at sets of interactions between being transition age and these different kinds of disadvantage that have been associated with lower access to care in previous research. So I think what's most important to take away from this is the sort of similar pattern you see in each of the four sets of interactions. So when kids are in transition and from a disadvantaged family, they have lower total expenditures overall than other kids. And in contrast, when kids that are not from disadvantaged families make up that difference by spending more out of pocket. So you can see kids who are from minority families and in transition have lower expenditures. The reference group in each case is not in transition, not a disadvantaged family. And kids who are not minority have higher out-of-pocket expenditures to make up that difference. Kids who are more highly impaired have lower total expenditures during transition age when they're transition age, and kids who are less impaired have higher out-of-pocket expenditures during transition. That's a little different story, but one possibility that I'll talk about a little more is that families who have less impaired kids may bear more of the burden of proving that their kids still need supports when they get back into the next level of school. Amongst low-income families, basically what we see is low-income families have lower expenditures and they don't have money to spend for out-of-pocket contributions either. For single women, kids in single women households, also they're spending less altogether. So I think what we take away from these patterns is that when kids with autism experience transition between schools, kids from disadvantaged families experience a drop in their total expenditures that's made up with out-of-pocket spending by families with more resources. The composition of total and out-of-pocket spending for autism differs, and nearly half of family out-of-pocket spending is devoted to prescription medications. For some limitations that are important to think about, these data only allow us to measure child age. They don't note the experience of school transition. Kids with disabilities, I think it's less frequent now, but earlier in our data, they may have been held behind. So our age is an approximate capture of transition. The National Longitudinal Transition Study is a great set of data on kids' school experiences, but they don't have the fine data on kid expenditures for medical care. Next, the MEPS asks families about medical care expenditures, and I think it's probably likely that some autism-related expenditures are left out of the picture here. So we know that, so there's no great evidence base for treatment for childhood autism, and families try a broad array of services. Some are medical services, some are from allied health, some are complementary and alternative medicine things, some are more social experiences, hippotherapy, dolphin therapy, things. And I think it's probable that when families were sitting down answering MEPS questions about your family's medical care expenditures, that some of that was left out. So our out-of-pocket measures are probably under-reporting true family out-of-pocket spending. And also, these are pooled data that cover a period of time when treatment patterns for autism have really been changing. Over this past decade, we've had more clear evidence that applied behavior analysis is an effective treatment for childhood autism. It's still hugely expensive and not greatly accessible, and it really varies across the country, but I think that's also something that was changing and not clear in these data. Okay, but implications. I think one possibility that we need to, that this kind of is like a canary in a coal mine. It kind of raises this red flag that we need to learn more about. Transition to a new school may be associated with a disruption of services for kids with autism. That's not necessarily, evil or bad. Both schools and families reasonably see transition to a new school as an opportunity to leave behind outgrown supports, and it's a time to try new things. And I know that a good working relationship between schools and families is going to lead to later readjustments that may bring back some supports or add new ones that raise back the level expenditures. So it's not, so we need to find out more about whether this is sort of a reasonable change in treatment plan or a problem. But what I think is important from these findings is what we see is that families who've typically experienced barriers to care, families unfamiliar with the system of care or who don't have the adequate resources for help seeking, are the ones whose children get fewer services. That's problematic. Other families seem to make up for these disruptions with greater out-of-pocket spending. And then here's this other thought, is it also may be that families with less impaired children bear more of a burden of proving to the schools that their kids still need more supports. It's another issue. So in terms of next steps, I think what we see is that insurance leaves significant need for out-of-pocket spending, a kind of pay-as-you-go strategy that leads to disparities still for kids with autism. The impacts of these disparities are unclear, and they warrant future study. It also raises questions about important dimensions of minimum essential benefits for kids as we approach clarity on health reform for kids with disabilities that need further study. Continuity of care. I think we need to look at continuity of care over the span of childhood. We're very familiar with how kids with special needs age out of the system, kids with mental health needs, when they leave high school and become adults, and there's a big gap there that we know about. These findings suggest that we need to look at fluctuations within childhood. And also I think we need to look at the composition of out-of-pocket spending and how that may be driving overall patterns of care, especially for autism, where we have a very limited evidence-based practice to go on. And so families know that these kids have a kind of short developmental window of time when they can find something that may work. And we don't have good outcome measures, so we don't know how to say, oh, that's working now. And so families just tend to try a lot of different things and try to decide what's working. And we don't want kind of frantic searching to be what's driving patterns, overall patterns of care for these kids. And then it may be, finally, that insurance benefit structure isn't really the answer, or isn't always the answer here, in that it's more systems of care and thinking about care collaborations and the kind of medical home models that may be what we really need to focus on in order to even things out for these kids. Thank you.